I don't need a passport to walk on this earth. Anywhere I go, cause I was made of this earth. I'm born of this earth, I breathe of this earth. And even with the pain, I believe in this earth. So I wake up every morning and I'm stepping on the floor. I wake up every morning and I'm stepping out the door. I got faith in the sky, faith in the one, faith in the people rocking underneath the sun. Cause every bit of land is a holy land, and every drop of water is a holy water, and every single child is a son or a daughter of the one earth mama and the one earth papa. So don't tell a man that he can't come here, cause he got brown eyes and a wavy kind of hair. And don't tell a woman that she can't go there, because she prays a little different to a God up there. You say you're a Christian cause God made you. You say you're a Muslim cause God made you. You say you're a Hindu and the next man a Jew. Then we all kill each other cause God told us to. No, hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Bonjour, bonjour.
Good morning. How's everybody doing? Wow, we made it to summer. Got through the solstice, and now hopefully everybody will have some fun this summer, and you know, regardless of everything that's going on in our world. There's a good show today. We have Chairman Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe to give an update on Dapple and on the whole Standing Rock situation. Because when we think of Standing Rock, we always think of the Standing Rock Sioux tribes, but there are many tribes in the area that have very big stakes in the water situation there and work with the Standing Rock tribe. And then it's William Rocha, who is the historian for the South Street Seaport, and they have a new exhibit on called Millions. And then we have Ali from up the block from the Bedouin Tent Restaurant. We're going to talk falafels. But before that, I was in South Dakota last weekend and I had the opportunity to meet State Senator Troy Hinert. I asked him about, you know, how he felt about the Dapple situation, and I want to just play this little clip from him. And by the way, we are out powwow, a powwow that was a thank you to the water protectors. That was really nice. And so you can hear powwow sounds in the background along with Senator Hinert.
Well, it was extremely disheartening when there was very few of us in the entire 105-seat legislature that believe that water is life and will publicly say it. You know, I brought legislation to stop Dapple, to stop KXL. We tried different ways of instituting tariffs on the pipe itself. We've tried to do taxing oil to make cleanup funds, and sadly they get shot down for no good reason. You know, we will continue that fight. We will continue to bring this issue forward, and you know, we have to just start changing hearts and minds. That's all there is to it.
We've got to keep changing hearts and minds. Yep, that does seem to be it. Changing hearts and minds to let everyone know the importance of water, of Mother Earth. You got to stay steadfast. Can't back down. Got to keep going, right? And before we go to my interview with Chairman Frazier, I just wanted to give an update about what's happened on July 14th and then following on July 21st. On the 14th, federal court judge James Boasberg found that federal permits that were issued by the Orange Man and his administration violated laws in three areas. The Army Corps of Engineers unlawfully failed to consider important information that the tribes provided them. Firstly, they failed to consider the risk of an oil spill in the Missouri River. Kind of a no-brainer, wouldn't you think? Secondly, they didn't consider the consequences of an oil spill on the tribe's treaty rights and also the effect it would have on the hunting and fishing that sustains many tribal members. And thirdly, the Army Corps failed to evaluate the environmental justice implications of having the pipeline routed right there within half a mile of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe land, when it, in fact the original route was up in Bismarck and it got moved. So that's no justice there. And then what happened after the 14th, there was a meeting of both the groups, DAPL and then also the tribal groups, and that happened on the 21st, the following Wednesday, and both sides in this lawsuit agreed to submit written arguments in July and August. And Jan Hasselman is an attorney for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and he said that they'd expect a decision sometime after that in September. Obama did stop the building of the Dakota Access Pipeline, called for the environmental impact statement, and that was going on. Trump came in and pushed everything through, and hence everything followed. The building was completed, and oil is pumping now under the Missouri River. And unfortunately, even though finding problems with it, they didn't stop the oil from flowing. So there's another 2 months here to work. And I'm sure we'll be calling out once, you know, we all hear, and you'll see it on Facebook, calls to write and, you know, just get behind this movement of stopping the flow of the oil under the river. And by the way, State Senator Heinert was one of the few out of the 105 people in the South Dakota legislation that voted against DAPL. We need more politicians like that. And speaking of good people in public service, here's my interview with Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier. Hello, Chairman Frazier. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I wanted to talk to you about what's going on with the whole no DAPL force right now, and especially in light of the ruling that came about a week ago Wednesday on July 14th, and then the follow-up meeting that happened yesterday on the 21st. And I'd also like to talk to you about the role that the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has been playing in everything with Standing Rock and with No DAPL.
What have we been doing?
Yeah, the role that Cheyenne River's been playing in this.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, we're greatly concerned with protection of the river. And, you know, we've always felt, and we do have a major stake in that process. I mean, our water intake is less than around 60, 70 miles from where the pipelines cross the river. And right now our water intake is it's our only source of water for our reservation. And our reservation encompasses about 3.1 million acres. Mm. And that's the only source of water. And you know, we are all part of the Great Sioux Nation, which we all have. We live under the same treaty. So we do, you know, have a role. There's not just us. There's also, and besides Standing Rock, there's the Ogallala Sioux Tribe, Rosebud, the Sisseton, Wahpeton, and Flandreau, Crow Creek, all of us. We all have a role to play.
Yeah.
And we all get our water from the Missouri River.
It's been interesting that, you know, camp closed on February 22nd, all of the Standing Rock camps. However, the Cheyenne River Reservation has a camp that's still ongoing, isn't it?
Well, we also have a camp on Standing Rock Reservation as well. We were fortunate to lease some land from an individual who owns it privately, and it is probably just yards away from the original, the Ocheti Shakoin camp, probably less than a quarter of a mile away.
Oh, wow.
We have a camp up there.
So basically the prayers are going, are there any direct actions, or is it basically a prayer camp where the presence is there and everyone's praying for the water and for the best outcome?
It's pretty much, you know, everyone just staying prayerful. There have been no type of action been trying to respect the you know, everything. So mm-hmm. there, I have written some letters to the Corps of Engineers, particularly to Colonel Henderson, mm-hmm. Asking him under what authority did he have to evict our people from the Ocheti Shakoin camp. Because under the Fort Laramie Treaty, 1868, it's Article 16 says, you know, on unceded lands, you know, you must get consent of the Indians before you could come in. And obviously that has not happened. So I'm questioning what authority does he have to kick our people out of unceded treaty lands.
Did Colonel Henderson get back to you?
Yes, he did. And he was just, you know, he quoted some regulations and the 1944 Flood Control Act. But however, you know, that treaty predates that any congressional laws. And, you know, it just seems like the federal government, in all their years of taking lands from our people, you know, they will not, and even today, will not look to honor that treaty. Instead, they will do an action, and then they will pass a federal law to justify whatever they have done. Mm. And that's the way we've been treated ever since.
And I'm so sorry for that. I know it's crazy, because when you listen to a lot of these politicians, it's like, oh, those treaties are so old. But then they'll go back to something like the Declaration of Independence, which is older, but that's just fine. Yeah.
Yes, you know, you're exactly right.
Yeah, that's, it's beyond aggravating, right? It's lives and it's respect and it's land and it's living, and what's gone on with all your nations has been terrible. What do you make out of the ruling that came out last week on the 14th, you know, stating that that the U.S. government is in violation?
You know, I think that's really, it's a glimmer of hope, you know, mm-hmm. glad that, you know, that the judge finally, or someone finally listening, you know, it is a glimmer of hope, and it really re-energized us to know that, you know, what we're doing is not going to be in vain, you know, that we are and we will, you know, accomplish, you know, stop this pipeline if we keep being, you know, persistent and stay unified. So it was a good deal.
Good. And now there's the second step to it, which is both parties giving information during July and August. Is there a game plan for that yet?
Well, we're going to, you know, naturally continue to, you know, look at what they're doing to process, you know, reviewing ours and, you know, getting our experts, you know, back to review documents and stuff like that. So, you know, other than, you know, still being in litigation, I hate to say too much.
Yeah, understood. Understood. I have a question, and if you feel this isn't appropriate, no need to answer, but I know there's an organization about that's looking into different pipelines where they're not even made correctly, where pipe fittings are off, where, again, it's not a matter of if it's going to leak, it's a matter of when. Have you looked at any of that, or has anyone? And perhaps it's something you don't want to talk about.
No, you know, that's something that we have had, because we submit, we've had some experts in different areas look at the, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline, mm-hmm. and you know, and there's raised a lot of concern, you know, with not only the type of materials, but I'm greatly concerned with the welds, you know.
Yeah.
It's been a couple months since I read the expert's opinion and findings, but they're going to pull, like, I think 190 pieces of pipe, four bands across that length, and, you know, and that's going to be a lot of stress on them welds. And I believe, if I remember correctly, the weight of them pipes were close to, God, I think 8 ton.
Oh, I'm clueless.
4 to 8 ton. So that's a lot of weight. So I hope like heck that them guys who welded them pipes together done a good job.
Yeah, yeah. It's always, you know, like humanity, a lot of us just have this sense that we're bigger than nature, and it doesn't hold up. It's like taking nuclear waste and trying to put it underground or in a mountain or in But ultimately it doesn't work. It leaks, you know, because we're not bigger than nature, and we're not bigger.
I think you said a good point, and we've always been saying that. You know, it's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
And that's something that we're working on right now. Next week we are having a water summit on our reservation to, you know, find ways, because what's going to happen if that pipeline does leak and our water is contaminated, and what do we do? You know, what do you do when you have 20,000 enrolled members?
So you're looking for alternate ways just as a backup and just in case to be safe?
Yes, yes. We have some aquifers and you know, some natural springs and things like that that we need to look at developing just to be prepared.
That's good to hear. Seeing you at camp, watching, and then following what you're doing along with all the other actions related to No Dapple and Standing Rock, you've done an amazing amount of work. You've really been at the forefront, and I applaud you for that.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, we were back in April. We were, you know, we rode, some of me and my staff rode when they first established the first sacred stone camp, you know, so we rode horseback in there.
Oh, you were there from the very beginning as well. Wow.
Yes.
In your wildest imagination, did you expect the turnout and everything, the good part of this that happened, the waking up of the world? Was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, it really was. I still think that's something that's very, really awesome. You know, I tell my family and close friends, I said, I don't know if we'll ever see that again in my lifetime, you know.
Yeah.
That was something pretty powerful.
Yeah, and I guess
And I've always looked at the positive of it, and I could personally say I never seen very much negative about that camp or any of the camps when I've been there, you know.
Yeah, nor have I.
It's really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen the beauty of it, the spirit of it, the power of it, people coming together for this common purpose, which is Mother Earth and caring for her and being very genuine in that.
Yes.
And, you know, for me, it was a privilege to be with all the Native people and to learn from you guys and, you know, to work and stand side by side.
Oh, yeah. Yep. No, that was good. I thank everybody, you know. I've always felt that, you know, I'm honored and grateful that all the people who stood up, you know, and particularly the ones who have sacrificed so much to stand up to protect that, you know, protect the water.
Yeah. Well, Chairman Frazier, I thank you for your time, and if you have any closing words or anything else you'd like us to know, please.
No. Well, I thank you for the opportunity. I think it's important that, you know, the more the people can hear our message, the better off, because I know here locally, the local media has really put a clamp on everything and have always reported, you know, one-sided, you know. So I thank you for the outside to of this area to spread our word and spread our message. So thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for all you do, and Mini Wichoni.
You bet, Mini Wichoni.
Be well.
beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Yep, the beat goes on. More things change. Sometimes the more they stay the same. Earlier this week, I was over at the South Street Seaport Museum to see their new exhibition, Millions, Migrants and Millionaires Aboard the Great Liners, 1900 to 1914. And it was curious to hear about how there were restrictions on the number of people and people from different countries at that point. And here's my interview with the wonderful historian over at the South Street Seaport Museum, William Rocha. Welcome, William.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
My pleasure. You know, before we talk specifically about the show, I'd love to talk about the seaport itself because it's somewhat of a very enchanting place. I love the old buildings there, and it must be fun being the historian there.
It is a very cool job to be the historian here at the South Street Seaport Museum. And the tagline for the museum is Where New York Begins, because the South Street Seaport Historic District, and that's a mouthful, it has some of the oldest buildings in Manhattan. And this is really, it speaks to the history of where New York became the New York that we know and love today. It laid the foundation for New York's greatness. And at the Seaport Museum, that's the story we try to tell through the historic buildings that we're housed in, to the 19th century letterpress print shops that we have, bound printers and bound stationers and company, and to our historic ships docked out on Pier 16. So there is a lot to see and do at the Seaport Museum.
And one of the ships, the Ambrose, is part of the exhibition that you have on now, Millions, along with the entry fee to Millions. You get to go aboard the ship. Is that correct?
That is correct. Now, what's very cool about Ambrose is in the exhibition, we're talking about the ocean liners at the start of the 20th century and how they all used to dock on the Hudson River carrying millionaires and immigrants from Europe. But really what marked their official arrival to New York and to the United States was passing this tiny little ship that was anchored about 13 miles off the coast of Coney Island, the Ambrose Lightship. And the Ambrose Channel was a special channel that had to be dredged to make the entrance to the harbor a little deeper so these giant ocean liners could safely enter the harbor. And the lightship Ambrose marked that. She was a floating lighthouse, and she has two lights on top of her masts, and they function just like in a lighthouse. And that marked the entrance to the channel and to New York Harbor. So in the exhibition, we have a model. We talk about what Ambrose's role was with these great liners. So after you can go to the exhibition, you can actually go aboard the original lightship Ambrose that we're talking about in this exhibition and see what the ship was like and how the life was for the crew aboard her.
That's neat. How many crew lived aboard her when they were out there?
It was about 11 guys out there. Mm-hmm. She didn't go anywhere. She was anchored out there permanently, you know, other than just having to come back for repairs on occasion.
Yeah.
She has these two massive anchors, mushroom anchors, and they went right down and they sank into the mud and kept her tight right on her spot there.
Wow. How long did the sailors stay out there? How long when they were working?
It was about 3 weeks on board the ship and then about 1 week off. So it was, there are stories of these sailors. They could be incredibly boring at times because you're out there for 3 weeks at a time. But stormy weather and also when these giant ocean liners were passing, it could be a little scary because Ambrose is not a very big ship.
Wow. Wow. And then take us inside on sort of an audio tour of the of Millions, if you would.
Well, when you first come in, on inside the exhibition, you know, there's the traditional intro giving some of the statistics and the important numbers to remember for this exhibition. Between 1900 and 1914, 13 million immigrants arrived here in New York, coming into the United States. At the same time, about every year, 100,000 first-class passengers traveled from the United States to Europe, and about 80% of these were Americans. So the way we've laid out the exhibition, and what's unique about this exhibition is it's taking a look at the lives of both the third-class passengers, the immigrants, and first-class passengers side by side.
Mm-hmm.
And this really hasn't been done a lot. And the reason we're doing it is because these people were traveling together on these ships, but their lives would never really intersect, but they were together on these ships. And that's what we try to cover in the exhibition. We look at what they ate, what the accommodations were, even what kind of baggage they had. And then we also take a look at why were they traveling, what kind of documentation was needed when they traveled, and then what was the process that each of the classes went through once they finally arrived back in New York City.
You know, I found it interesting that I was looking at the menus, and on the third class menu, they even mentioned the brand of the product, like Quaker Oats. And then for dinner, they had gruel. Oy, but way different menus.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We have two of the menus out there, and they sit next to pieces of china. One is a little cup and saucer, beautifully decorated, from first class. And then we have a plain white simple plate from third class. And then next to those are these menus. And just to note that the menus are actually recreations down there because the originals are a little too fragile to put out on display. But these recreations were made by the museum's 19th century style print shop, Bound Printers. And the Bound Printers also did all the design work for the exhibition. Everything has a special meaning in the exhibition, so a lot of thought and work went into it. Now, what was interesting about the menus, from the type of paper to the type of type that was used to print the letters, everything was of a different quality. The first class menu, which is for only one of the many meals that they would get aboard on a day on the ship, is it actually has gilding on the edges and has beautiful embossed symbol of the White Star Line company. And then it lists all the food, and it's of the highest quality paper. The third class menu is much more simple, plain, only printed in a single color, and it lists all the meals for the whole day.
You know what else I found curious was that I expected the third class accommodations to be worse than what they were from the photographs, but you explained to me it was because of health regulations that came in. When did those health regulations change where that the third class people had to be in a clean environment? I mean, it was very cramped, but it was clean.
No, it started in the 1880s. The United States started issuing laws and regulations to improve the accommodation for passengers, particularly third-class passengers. And that's because they simply didn't want ill people arriving in the United States. And then through the next three decades, the rules increasingly became more and more strict. And it was actually in the economic interest of the steamship companies then to make sure that the quality of accommodations was good enough to make sure that the health of the passengers would be good once they arrived in New York and were processed through Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm.
Because if an immigrant was rejected at Ellis Island, the steamship company had to pay to take the passenger back to Europe, and they didn't want to pay that extra money. So they wanted to make sure all the immigrants that they were taking through were getting through Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm. So were these ships coming over to the United States chock-a-block full and going back with just basically your first-class people for the most part?
Well, actually, interesting, there was a lot of back and forth. When they came over from Europe, they were much more full. Third class would usually be almost completely booked out, and it would fluctuate by season. The spring and summer would be the best time to cross the Atlantic. If you were looking for a bargain, you could do it in the winter, but you'd get tossed about on the stormy seas of the North Atlantic. But also when the ships went out to Europe, first class would be incredibly booked with all the Americans heading to their vacations in Europe. But third class also would be maybe about halfway full, because a lot of these immigrants, sometimes they were taking trips back to Europe mm-hmm. because they had done quite well in the United States, and they were either visiting family back in Europe, or they had decided that, you know, I've worked, I earned enough here in the United States, and I actually want to go back home to Italy or Hungary or wherever they had originated from.
I see. Another thing you had mentioned to me that was of interest was there were quotas on peoples from different countries. And, you know, it almost is a parallel to nowadays. We want these people in, we don't want those people in. And would you speak to that? You mentioned about an embargo, I think, for there were too many Chinese, or they were not letting any more Chinese people come in.
Well, that was one of the most pointed immigration regulations, was specifically against people coming from China, and that was already dating back to the 1880s. Mm. For immigrants from Europe, the issue was by the 1890s, the immigration had really changed from where these people were originating from in Europe, and so instead of coming originally from Scandinavia, Germany, Great Britain, Ireland, they were now coming from Russia, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Eastern Europe, Italy, and for many of the traditional Americans, the Anglo-Saxon Americans, they weren't really sure that these East Europeans, Southeast Europeans would be able to integrate into mm-hmm. American society. Then World War I broke out, and the anti-immigration feeling really started to pick up steam, and then legislation was passed first in 1921 and then in 1924. And these were very strict quota systems based on the American census. And they were based on the years of the census when there weren't that many East Europeans in the United States. So it was purposely done to keep the numbers very, very low then from these countries coming into the United States. And one number particularly illustrates this. Pre-World War I, the Italian numbers were about 300,000 Italians every year were immigrating into the United States. After 1924, it was less than 3,000 would be admitted into the United States.
Whoa.
Because of these quotas.
That's huge.
It was an incredible, incredible decline, and it was specifically pointed at these people coming from these different parts of Europe that were no longer really being felt welcome.
Wow. How long is the exhibit running?
The exhibition will be up until January of 2018.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And if anyone wants more information, the website is southstreetseaportmuseum.org. And William, I'm curious, how did you get into being a historian?
Well, I studied history in university, and I've always had a great love of history and particularly of ocean liners. I started as a small kid as a Titanic geek.
Oh, wow.
And it's ballooned out since then, and I've been loving learning every aspect that is related to ocean liners, from the economics to immigration to even the politics of it back then. And I've been very lucky enough that I've been able to go attend academic conferences and do presentations on this research. And now I've been able to put that research and turn it into the exhibition here at the museum. So it's really exciting.
That is totally exciting. You're so in your element. That's, boy, I love that. Cool jobs are where it's at.
Yes, yes.
Oh, William Rocha from the South Street and Seaport Museum, thank you so much.
Crocodiles, oh. walk like an Egyptian.
Oh, I'm so lucky today. I'm here with Ali Ali from Bedouin Tent here on Atlantic Avenue. And it's really funny because this week it seems that it's the day of or the week of visiting neighborhoods. Because earlier this week I was by the South Street Seaport talking with my guest, William, the historian from the South Street Seaport. And that's the old WBAI neighborhood when we were at 120 Wall and was hanging out there, just remembering all the times that I fed the seagulls. So today we're back on Atlantic Avenue with Ali from Bedouin Tent. Welcome, Ali.
Very welcome. I'm so glad because I'm with you now.
Thank you so much. Everybody here loves you and loves your food. So Bedouin Tent's a Middle Eastern restaurant and you specialize in falafel. So I wanted to bring you here so we could talk about falafels.
We can talk about falafel.
Well, when we were talking the other day, you mentioned that falafels are like really, really ancient. How old are they? Would you tell us about their history?
Actually, the falafel come from Egypt long time ago. And the falafel was two things, not only one. The people think falafel only.
Yeah.
There is a tamia also. Tamia, but the ingredient from fava beans. And falafel from chickpeas. This is the difference between them.
Okay. So that, yeah, because I was looking up falafels and then I was reading that some are made with chickpeas and some are made with fava beans.
Yes.
But they're two different items then. It's not... Yeah?
Similar taste, you know, but depend. Chickpeas is more harder than fava beans.
Mm-hmm.
Soft. Fava beans is soft when you do it soft. And the taste is great also.
Mm-hmm. When you make the ones in your restaurant, which do you use?
Actually, I mix it.
Oh, boy, that's why you wouldn't give me your recipe, your secret recipe that you won't share. I don't blame you. It's really good. Although I'm not good. Now I am not about to open up a falafel restaurant.
Why not? To try. I love the competition, you know.
You're not going to get it from me. Got a couple of other irons in the fire at the moment. So how far back does falafel go?
Falafel back in Egypt. To long time ago from Egypt. Started in Egypt like maybe 700 years ago. But like in this time, start in Egypt, then go to for Syria, Lebanon, for over
all
there.
Throughout the Middle East. But it did originate in Egypt. That's cool. And you're from Egypt yourself, aren't you?
Yes. And in Egypt was from fava beans, then convert for chickpeas in other cities.
So falafel started with fava beans.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know, I was reading something else about making them, and this is not your whole recipe, so it's just I'm curious. Do you actually take the fava bean and or the chickpea and you soak them but don't cook them before you fry them?
I boiled them before.
You do boil them.
And ground it. Mm-hmm. And I add my stuff on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Parsley, garlic, onions. Some special spice.
Secret sauce,
spice.
Secret stuff, okay. All right. But, and you know, everything, wow, I'm going to ask you for another recipe, but maybe you'll say yes
you
or
can
no.
Ask.
I can ask, exactly, I can ask.
I'm not answer.
Your hummus is delicious. I make homemade hummus, and I'm not happy with the way I make it. I don't like it, but your hummus is awesome, and that's freshly made too, isn't it?
Because it's fresh. We sell a lot. That's why fresh every time.
Mm. So, and you also make the tahini?
Tahini, I buy tahini
from
the
tahini.
Market.
Yeah, that must,
But the good hummus come from good olive oil, and the good tahini.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
If you put tahini, the level is down, is doesn't help you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I buy the tahini in the health food store, but I don't know. I'm not pleased with
it. Have good quality, make it good food. You
yeah.
know?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll share ratios of tahini to hummus, tahini to chickpeas to olive oil with me.
Make this great.
Okay. How long have you been here in the United States?
I've been here
States?
From 1999.
Oh, wow. What brought you here?
What you mean?
Why did you come to the States rather than
actually,
staying?
I came here from Holland. I've been live in Holland.
Oh.
And then come to visit my brother here.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with New York.
Did you really? I'm curious. Yeah. I was going to ask you that. What do you really like about New York or love about New York?
New York, everything in my life. I love New York. My second country, New
yeah.
York. Egypt and New York, like twins in my heart.
Really? What especially, though, about New York do you like?
I love New York because here is everything is clean. I wish I see my city like New York. The people is kind, and there is a more freedom here.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I love New York.
Do you get to visit Egypt?
I visit every year, yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Do you go all over? I know you're from Alexandria.
Yes, 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 yes. The most beautiful city, Alexandria, over there.
You know, oh gosh, I so regret. Well, I have to go back to visit because
sure.
I visited yeah. Egypt and I went to Upper Egypt, but I didn't get to Alexandria. And I
this
I
mean you didn't visit Egypt?
I don't know. I was inside a pyramid. That kind of, I think I was
did
there.
Did you see the pyramid?
Yeah.
Yeah. How yeah. did you feel when you see the pyramid over there?
Oh, it, I don't know if it was breathtaking. It was just so amazing to be there. One of the things that really struck me was when I was in the valley, I don't remember if it was the Valley of the Kings or the Valley of the Queens
oh,
in
yeah.
Luxor.
Yeah, Luxor, yeah.
Yeah, I really Aswan. Loved it there. Yeah. Oh, my God, Aswan. The yeah. Bedouins dancing was amazing.
Exactly,
oh,
yeah.
wowie. And I stayed at the Cataract Hotel, the one that was written about in Death on the Nile, and that was an amazing experience. But in Luxor, going to, I don't remember if it was Valley of the Kings or the Valley of the Queens, but going into the grave, you know, there was an Egyptian man in his galeba, the long gown, right?
Yeah.
And he's holding a mirror so that the reflection of the sun comes and lights up my way down below.
Yeah.
And I was just in there and I was just so struck, and I'm looking at the stars on the ceiling that were painted, and I'm thinking, this was done 5,000 years
yes,
ago.
And the same.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm crazy for Egypt and the antiquities. Mm-hmm. And being in the pyramids was wonderful. I don't quite even know how I got in. I met somebody outside that I don't mm-hmm. He was not an official anything, but he took me inside the pyramid. And that was pretty
yeah.
amazing
yeah.
by itself, being in the king's chamber.
Oh, was yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an amazing country, and it breaks my heart that all the problems there have been, and I know because tourism is such a great part of the economics there,
yeah.
and because of all the things that have happened, I know tourism's been down for well over a decade, maybe two decades, yeah?
Yeah. Actually, the revolution in French stay like 14 years to back to normal, and Egypt now only 3 years, but we killed the corruption for Mubarak president. He was very bad. Yeah, but
so
now we wish now gonna be better. We wish.
Oh, I hope so. I really do yeah. because you're all beautiful people.
Yeah, there is a kind people and
yes.
very simple people, very kind, you know.
Yeah, very kind. I recall being there and it was really wonderful.
Yeah, what year you go there?
Oh gosh, it was a long time ago. It's probably around 1991.
Was Mubarak.
Yeah.
This time was president.
Yeah, it was Mubarak, yeah.
Mubarak, president, yeah. We wish. We wait.
Yeah, yeah. You have family there?
I have my family. My kids are over there, yeah.
Then they come visit you, you
yeah,
see them?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Did you open Bedouin tent yourself? Or?
Actually, I'm not own the Bedouin tent. I just like manager. For Bedouin tent. I'm not on it.
Oh, well, yeah. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, yeah. And gotcha. Wonderful customer around us.
Yeah.
Very good people, you know, yeah. Very kind.
Well, it's funny. Everybody here loves your store. everybody. And loves the food. I love sitting outside.
Because we love you also.
Aww, thank you. Love me enough to give me your recipe for hummus?
Okay, before I leave, I'm going to give you that recipe.
All right, good, good. Because I can't keep making bad hummus. Ali, thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you, sweetheart. I'm so glad to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good day.
Walk like an Egyptian.
Well, that's it for this week, but I want to thank my guest, Chairman Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, William Rocha of the South Street Seaport Museum, and Ali of Bedouin Tent. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to the engineers that helped me get this together this week. Ever hardworking Reggie Johnson, Tony Ryan, and Max Schmid. Thanks, guys. All of you have a wonderful week, and I'll talk to you soon. Later.
You say that once you knew for sure. Now you're walking in the shore to wonder. The more you learn, the less you know. The more you move, the more you go to nowhere. You ask a bird as she flies by just where she's at, and she says where the wind blows. Ask her by that what she means. She says she doesn't know, but as she flew away, she seemed to say the wind. Staggered to your room, sleep by day and plot by moon your conscious plight. Pack your dreams, you move away, decide to eat and live by day and leave the night. City sun blinks in your eyes, you shade your face and realize a lonely crowd. Then at once you feel the smile, and then the ice warm air moves by. She says the breeze provokes her sigh. The wind is the wind is my love. Who knows the wind?
smile of. We're blown.